Okay, you're listening to CKUT Radio. I'm Joe Broadhurst, 90.3 on your FM dial in Montreal, and I'm glad to be joined this morning by or with Dave Lindorf. Good morning.
Good.
I am calling. I'm talking with you this morning. You have written an interesting article on December 19th in Counterpunch, and it also appeared on your website, which is thiscan'tbehappening.net. And it's called 9/11 Missing Black Boxes in World Trade Center Attacks Found by Firefighters, Analyzed by NTSB, and Concealed by the FBI. And I was wondering, first of all, Dave Lindorf is an award-winning investigative reporter. You've been a journalist for 30 years. You've been a teacher. You've written three books, which I'll mention later. You have a new book coming out called Case for Impeachment, the legal argument for removing President George W. Bush from office. And I thank you for joining me this morning.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. Great.
What have you found out concerning these black boxes? Because these black boxes, this is such a strange story around these black boxes. Can you give our listeners a little bit of history around it and what you found out?
Well, of course, there were four planes that that crashed on 9/11. The one that hit the Pentagon, the two that hit the two World Trade Center towers, and the one that crashed in a field in rural Pennsylvania. And you know, by law, every commercial airliner has to carry two of these boxes. They're actually orange boxes, but they call them black boxes. And one is a flight data recorder, which records all the movements of the plane, the airspeed, turns it makes, all the altitude, and that kind of record. And then any sudden acceleration or deceleration, too, that kind of stuff. And then the voice cockpit recorder, which records the last 30 minutes of conversation in the cockpit of the airplane. That sort of recycles all the time, so the back gets erased and the front is added. And these boxes are designed for surviving the worst kind of crash. They're supposed to survive a fire of 1,000 degrees centigrade for up to 30 minutes and still provide usable information. And they're supposed to be able to survive a head-on crash into an obstacle, so in, you know, a total deceleration from 500 miles an hour to zero in a matter of feet. So they should survive these crashes, and in fact, I believe I was told that in 99% of the crashes that have occurred since these boxes were designed, they've been recovered. They've recovered them from the bottom of the ocean. They've recovered them from bombed airplanes. They've recovered them from head-on collisions between two planes.
Let's look at what they also did find. I mean, they found we've seen pictures of engines. Those didn't melt to death. We've seen the passport, the infamous passport.
Well, even parts of planes that are made out of aluminum survived, and that. You know, as you know, that burns at a much lower temperature than the fires were. So there was a tremendous amount of stuff that survived. And as you say, that things survived that are instantly flammable with a match. So, and they did find some of these boxes. They found the boxes from the Pennsylvania crash, and they found the boxes in the Pentagon.
Which is the strangest thing, because if we're talking, if you look on the internet or see anything about what the conspiracies behind 9/11, they can't find a plane at the Pentagon, and who knows what happened in Pennsylvania, because we have reports that they were shot down.
Yeah, well, I have stayed away from speculation because to be honest, I'm not a conspiracy buff on this. I think that. I know all the arguments that planes didn't hit the plane didn't hit the Pentagon, and that the planes that hit the towers were not really passenger planes. And frankly, I don't buy those, just because, for one thing, I had a classmate of mine's wife die on one of the planes that hit the World Trade Center, so nobody's going to tell me that these weren't passenger planes.
Okay.
And secondly, you know, there are things that are not true that are being said among conspiracy theorists. Just for example, in the Pentagon, there were plane parts found. That's simply not correct. But
misinformation.
Yeah, there's misinformation out there. There's more than enough questions going around that I think are valid that we don't have to go off into deep space with conspiracy theories that you know, go way out there beyond what's reasonable. But, you know, that said, you know, one of the questions that has to be asked is, why are these boxes missing? Because they were reported found, and not in internet and alternative publications like I write for. They were reported by the Philadelphia Daily News by a reporter named Will Bunch as having been found only a few days after the crash, and they were found by two guys working with the fire department at clearing up the rubble at a time when they were looking really hard for body parts. Recall they were trying to find, among other things, actually I think they were still looking for survivors at the point that the boxes were found. So they were pouring over this enormous pile of rubble with a fine-tooth comb.
Down to minute pieces of skin and stuff just to get DNA, right?
That's right. And you know, they identified, I think it's worth mentioning that they identified 1,500 people out of the, you know, 2,000 some odd who died in those two crashes, and in order to find the, you know, three quarters, or I guess it was 58% of the people that were killed, is phenomenal in the amount of wreckage that was there. So they really were carefully pouring over this stuff. So it isn't surprising that, you know, bright orange boxes that don't get destroyed were found. And these guys said that they were carted away by federal agents. And then, you know, people start going, yeah, right, sure. Well, now I've got confirmation from the NTSB, the National Transportation Safety Board, which is the agency that examines these boxes, that has the technology and equipment to analyze what's on these boxes, to recover damaged ones and make them work. And what I was told by a source at that agency was that they had the boxes brought to them by the FBI and returned to the FBI. And what I was told was that you'll have to get the official word from the FBI. You know, we can't give you that information. It's off the record. But the truth is, we had them. The FBI denies it, and as they have been denying it. But that would mean that they're lying not only to me, and to the American public, but to the 9/11 Commission, which asked what had happened to the boxes, and the FBI said that they had the ones from the other two crash sites, but not from the World Trade Center. So what's going on, we don't really know. You know, there are all kinds of speculations as to why they might not want those boxes released, but whatever those are, none of them are justified. There's no national security violation in telling people we have them and what their condition was.
And we, you know, we watched for days those planes fly into those buildings over and over and over.
Mm-hmm.
And what they're going to get from the boxes are how fast the plane was flying. What
turns they made.
What turns they made.
What was being said in the cockpit.
What
by
was being,
these people who were in the cockpit.
I mean, and
if
they,
anything.
And they are the ones that named the 19 people that were, you know, had hijacked the planes. I just don't understand what the reasoning is behind this.
Well, one writer, after I wrote the article, suggested that what we might find on the voice recorders is no conversation, because they say since nobody could have flown those planes that well with the minimal amount of training that the hijackers are alleged to have had, maybe the planes were brought in by homing devices.
And that's definitely one of the theories that is out there, right?
Yeah, and there's, you know, that would imply a level of sophistication and inside preparation that somebody may not want us to know about. And you could move into all levels of conspiracy theory. You could have it be some rogue element within the U.S. government. You could have it be just a much more elaborate terrorist operation that realized they had to get control of the planes but could never hope to fly them into the building, so you simply put them on autopilot, targeting a beacon that you place into the buildings beforehand.
And that technology, they have proved, has been available. So, okay. You do much more than, I want to talk a little bit more than about this story. I think the story is fascinating, and I think more people should be questioning their government about it. What do you think about the NSA spying? How do you think that the U.S. is reacting to what Bush has done?
Well, it's added a chapter to my book, even as I'm writing.
Oh, really?
So, yeah, I mean, the impeachment book needs a chapter on the NSA spying, because what I think is interesting about the NSA spying story is twofold. One is it confirms what a lot of people were reporting already, that the administration has been targeting domestic dissent since 9/11. And equating it with terrorism. We had roughly at the same time that the NSA story was reported, and I should add that it was known to the New York Times for a year, and they held the story.
I really can't believe that, and more people should be making an uproar over that.
Yeah, it's just amazing. I mean, the Times just goes from one disaster to the next. You know, they had the Judy Miller conspiracy to
sell the war,
pump the war up before it happened, and shill for the Pentagon and Cheney, and then we find out that this information, which could have thrown the election the other way, was held by the Times for a year. But you know, at the time the story broke, we were also having a story break in the Washington Post that organizations like this actually came from the ACLU, in a Freedom of Information filing, that hundreds and perhaps thousands of anti-war groups, peace organizations, right down to little Quaker meeting groups, were being infiltrated and spied on and monitored by the federal government, probably in part through this NSA operation to monitor phones and internet. And so, you know, it confirms what appears to be going on. And I think that, you know, one of that obviously the reason that the administration chose not to use the federal federal intelligence courts, secret courts, to get warrants for this kind of domestic spying was because it knew it wouldn't get the warrants, even from a court that's famous for having granted almost every request that was ever made of it, because they were doing something that was so blatantly illegal, spying on domestic legal activity. So to keep it secret, they had to do it extra legally. And this would be a reversion right back to the pre-1978 law era of COINTELPRO, when the government routinely was spying on Americans doing legal protest activity. So that's one element of it. The other thing that's fascinating and scary about the NSA spying is the rationale that the government has come forward with for the spying, and that is that the president can basically do anything he wants by citing a bill passed by Congress in the week after 9/11, in which they authorized him to use any force necessary to combat the terrorists behind 9/11. So they're saying, well, any force necessary, that means, you know, we can do spying. And you know, that raises the question of what can't you do if you cite that bill? It's ludicrous, of course. I mean, spying is not force. They're saying, well, war involves intelligence, and so we have to do intelligence. I mean, war involves mass arrests, so maybe they should now do mass roundups and kinds of dissidents or whatever. I mean, they could justify basically anything by that argument. So it's essentially saying that the president is a king wants.
Well, and they first came out, one of their first excuses was speed. But
that doesn't fly.
That doesn't fly either, right?
Well, no, because the law allows the government to wiretap for 3 days before getting a retroactive warrant from the court. So, and they could even do it in an extreme circumstance where they didn't think they'd get the warrant and be rejected, and they'd still have acted legally if they went in within 72 hours and asked for a warrant. So there is no need for speed since you don't have to have the warrant.
It's incredible. I want to take a quick minute or two to talk about Mumia Abu-Jamal's case. You wrote a book. You were one of the first ones to write a book about Mumia. What can you tell us about the revelations that came about at the beginning of December?
You mean the latest court decision?
Yeah.
Well, it's actually quite a breakthrough for the defense in this case. Jamal has been, as your listeners probably know, on death row since the middle of 1982 when he was convicted of having killed a white police officer. This is a former Black Panther and Philadelphia journalist who was charged with a 1981 killing of a police officer. And so he's one of the longest sitting death penalty prisoners in the U.S. And he had had a federal court decide in 2001 that that all of his claims of constitutional problems with his trial, with his conviction, were not valid. The judge, only in one instant out of 20 claims, felt that there was enough question about the claim that he certified it for appeal to the Third Circuit Court, which is the second-to-last step in the appeals process right before the Supreme Court. And he certified this one area for appeal, so they had the right to appeal on only that one ground, which was racial bias in jury selection. And so that was a narrow single shot at trying to get a new trial. But the Third Circuit looked at the appeal and said that they found two other reasons why he had grounds to appeal, and they are now going to accept appeals from Jamal's attorneys on that jury selection issue, plus claim that the prosecutor improperly weakened the sense of responsibility on the part of the jury by saying that they didn't have to worry about convicting him and maybe being wrong because there would be appeal after appeal after appeal. You're not allowed to do that. Courts have repeatedly thrown out convictions when prosecutors have said that, and in fact, this very prosecutor had a case overturned by the Third Circuit for saying exactly those words in another death penalty case. I mean, the argument is if a jury is supposed to convict on evidence that proves a case beyond a reasonable doubt, so if they have a reasonable doubt, they shouldn't say, oh, well, we can convict him anyway because there'll be appeal after appeal after appeal. They should not convict him.
Yeah.
So this was a major transgression on the part of the prosecutor, and so it seems quite possible that that could overturn the trial. And then on another ground, they found that the defense should be able to appeal based on the evident bias of the trial judge during the post-conviction hearing at which the court had to consider the validity of the evidence in the case. So, if they can prove, and I think it's an easy case, it should be a slam dunk, to quote our CIA chief, that this trial judge was biased. I mean, this is a guy who walked out of court on the first day and said, I'm going to help them fry that nigger.
Nice.
You know, clearly the local paper editorialized during the post-conviction hearing that the judge had shamed the court because of his evident bias for the prosecution. So it's a clear case. If they find that on appeal, that the judge was biased, then they'd have to go back and reopen the post-conviction hearing at which the defense could bring in new evidence, new witnesses, recall old witnesses, and question them, because the judge back then cut off questioning of some very key witnesses, so the defense never got to ask some very important questions and correct trial testimony that had been erroneous or fraudulent. So there, it really is three big openings in this case, and that'll come up this spring. It'll be heard in April and May.
Okay, I've been joined by Dave Lindorf. He is a writer of a book on Mumia Abu-Jamal. It's called Killing Time, An Investigation into the Death Row Case of Mumia Abu-Jamal. He is also, you can find him at thiscan'tbehappening.net. He has a new book coming out, Case for Impeachment, The Legal Argument for Removing President George W. Bush from Office. And I guess that'll be coming out in March or something, or in April. Late April, early May.
I can finish it.
Well, yeah, you have to add a new chapter every month, you know.
Yeah, it's a rolling target now, so quite exciting.
All right, well, thank you very much for joining me this morning. I hope we can speak to you again, and have a nice day.
Thanks for having me on. Have a good holiday.
Thanks a lot, you too.
Bye-bye.
Bye.